Today it'll be some discussion of my experiences with the Moonies, something about Reverend Moon now who's in jail in Danbury, Connecticut. I say a few words about that. Something about religion and politics, if that's something of the theme. I don't think I have to do a commercial tomorrow about Billy Graham, although Graham has changed a great deal in the last 7-8 years, and I want to talk something about that. There's been a significant change in what Graham has, some of his acts, some of his emphases, and some of his, his important themes that he's been developing. So I'll talk about that. And I want to say a few words about my attendance at some Moonie conferences, try to convince you that I haven't been brainwashed, as my son and also some of you know Dan Erlander was convinced that I was going to be brainwashed. I was here last summer just before I went to the conference, and Dan was very worried. He said he's even going to pray for me, for goodness sake, that I was going to be brainwashed. And my son met me at the airport in Minneapolis when I got back, and very, very concerned about the heavenly deception and all the rest of the things. And I'll talk about that, try to talk as candidly as I can about this. And then something about what the Moonies believe, and something about some of the criticisms. And if we want to get into this whole question about cults, and what I like to call it, it's a polite term from sociology, perimeter groups. They're on the edge. They're not in the mainstream. Mainstream would be Lutheran, Episcopal, Catholic, you know, Presbyterian, and so on. And some groups slightly to the edge would be Jehovah's Witness, Seventh-day Adventist, groups like that. If I were in Salt Lake City today, I wouldn't put, you know, the Mormons on the on slightly to off center, but they would be, you know, right in the middle. But from the perspective of Minneapolis, they look slightly to the, you know, to the right. And that, you know, that somebody calls Minneapolis that great Lutheran womb of the North, and I think that's possibly the case. Not to say St. Paul, which is more Irish Catholic, but anyway. And then just simply open it up for your comments, your questions, and again, I would encourage people to raise critical kinds of questions. There is a very real question, and I'll face it, you know, right away, the first thing here. In a way, some people have said, haven't you really been bought, or what we like to call it, co-opted, by attending two Moonie conferences where all your, you know, all your expenses were paid for? Isn't this a way that Moonies have with all their enormous resources, and I'll talk about that, of winning over or doing a PR blitz on people who might not otherwise have been quite as sympathetic for them? And I'll just let that one sit on the agenda there for a while, and maybe the back burner for a little while. And my own sort of conclusion is that I went to some of the Moonie conferences with some ideas, and many of the ideas were changed, and not all for the better. I've come away with some different, and in a different way, more critical attitudes towards what the Moonies are trying to do in this country. Okay, to get to the sort of the most recent point first, last Thursday, if I'm not mistaken, or Friday, Reverend Moon was arrested and placed in jail along with one of his top assistants in a medium security level jail in Danbury, Connecticut. And that in itself is important because it's very rare in all of American history that an ordained minister should be arrested and placed in jail. In fact, the only one I can think of before, the only two I should think I can think of before would be the Berrigan brothers, you remember, in the late 1960s, the early 1970s, Daniel and Philip Berrigan, who were arrested for attempting to destroy draft records in Maryland. That's right, they were pouring blood on, wasn't it, human blood on draft records. And the Catonsville Eight, wasn't it? I think it was, and something like that. And you had all these different groups, the Milwaukee number, they had a certain number, and then when they exposed Watergate, they had the White House 5,000 was what they came up with, all the people they had to arrest there, okay, or put in jail. But anyway, Reverend Moon was placed in jail not because of any particular, you know, crime such as the Berrigans did against property. There's no question that the Berrigans were guilty of that particular crime, a felony, but he was convicted because of evasion of paying taxes and not reporting taxable income. And that, and I think it's the total of $260,000 is the total that was caused, that was at stake there. And the issue is really one of more than simply somebody not turning in all the records. The question that hasn't been solved by the Supreme Court, although they did send Moon to jail, and they didn't, but they didn't rule on the case. They didn't pass down an opinion on this, as oftentimes they obviously do. They just simply upheld the lower court decision, a federal court of appeals, without comment, and probably for good reason, because it's an extremely complicated and extremely controversial case, and it has to do with the extent to which church property and church income is taxable. And that really hasn't been settled to any clear degree in this country. Even up in Minneapolis, for instance, I think it was about 20 years ago, there was a case where it came up with nothing less than Augsburg Publishing House. You wouldn't think that that would get in trouble. Good old 426 South Fifth Street, 55440 and all the rest. But the City Council of Minneapolis, it's a good case to lead into the Mooney case. The City Council of Minneapolis was looking for more sources of revenue, and they decided that here was Augsburg Publishing, which had a large press and was putting out a lot of different printed materials, and that looked like a business, and businesses should be subject to taxes. And so they passed, a majority passed a bill claiming that Augsburg Publishing should pay taxes. The only problem was that nobody, no one individual, nor no group stockholders, profited from any of the revenue that Augsburg Publishing generated. The money simply went right back into into APH again, or Augsburg Publishing again, and therefore there was no place in which you could, where you could tax. It was useful, though, that case, because it raised the question, what about those church owned and organized revenues which don't go back into what we would call religious or charitable philanthropic organizations again? Isn't it possible that there are some churches which generate revenue, which produce profit enterprises, where the money actually becomes, in a very real sense, private property. Private income is a better word, I should say. Private income there. And the government has decided that in those cases, that is taxable income, and that the churches should pay taxes on that particular amount, that kind of money. There are some, for instance, some publishing houses who take on private printing. They want to keep their employees busy or employed all the time, and so if the work isn't, if the job load isn't enough, they will take on some private printing. And they argue, the government argues, that the revenue from that should be taxed, because that's private printing, just the way something like Western Publishing, just to choose a term, a house I know would be involved with that. Okay, now that is where the trouble starts, because there are those in the organized religious community who argue that once you start to tax any church property, any church income, you're really putting the state in control of the churches. And it's a violation of separation of church and state. You see, that's a basic issue at stake here. Once, because who was it? Way back, Chief Justice Marshall, wasn't it, who said the power to tax is the power to destroy. And what if the church would start picking on, what if the church didn't like Seventh-day Adventists, or they didn't like Jehovah's Witnesses, or they didn't like this group or that group? They could simply start taxing that particular group. And then the power to tax, obviously, is the power to destroy. And some churches would be at a marked disadvantage simply because they were churches, but they were following certain kinds of policies which the government didn't happen to approve. There was one, maybe you saw it in 60 Minutes 3-4 years ago, which included smoking of marijuana during the worship service as a part of their, of their liturgy. And the Rastafarians, isn't that the name of it? I can't pronounce it right, but... And anyway, that was the group, and they, they lost. If you're wondering about this, they lost, but they must have had a good time, when they were, as they went along. All right. The question really is the extent to which you can do certain things under the claim, you see, of religious freedom. The old ones here about Jehovah's Witnesses not allowing their children to have blood transfusions because it's in Leviticus 20-something, I think it is, about blood transfusions. They say it's blood transfusions, and how far do you go with that sort of thing? Children being, their parents of children not wanting them to have sex education in the public schools because that's a violation of what they want to teach their children about sex and so on. Okay, you see the issue. So what happened was that Reverend Moon lost the decision. It was $260. It's $1,000. It's a sizable amount. And then what was fascinating, it was in June, I think I mentioned this Tuesday, there was a rally in Minneapolis, as there had been in about 7-8 other cities around the country, which was sponsored by various religious and civil rights organizations claiming that Moon had become, was being persecuted by the government. And if, would you believe, I had to see it myself, I like to do field research, and I went to see this one. This was at the Holiday Inn Central, downtown Minneapolis. And it was Moral Majority ACLU. That indicates right there, what a strange mixture we have right from the beginning. Mormons, Catholics, Black Baptists, talk about your rainbow coalition. There it was, and they were all claiming that, and it was about a 2-hour service. So they were all claiming religious persecution. And they see it as an organized plot on the part of the government, and they pointed not only to Moon going to jail, and they argued, you see, Moon was going to jail not only because of the taxing, but Moon was an Oriental, and therefore there is some racial prejudice involved in this sort of thing, and also that the Moonies make all kinds of money, and they certainly do. And I'll talk about that too, and that therefore the government was looking for some way to get some more revenue. They also plugged in not only with Reverend Moon, but as the other part, as one more part of this organized religious conspiracy. Some of you remember about 2 years ago, and it's another fascinating aspect of the same question of religious liberty, this fundamentalist Christian day school in Nebraska, which refused to hire certified teachers. This is a real battleground, and we're not going to solve it today. If we did, we could write in and Secretary of Education or whatever it is in Washington and solve the problem for them. But they refused to have certified teachers in Nebraska. And the Nebraska, I think the Nebraska police overreacted slightly. These weren't organized anarchist guerrillas or something, the tactical fighters ready to overthrow the state government of Nebraska. But on the other hand, they overplayed it too, because they locked themselves in and they locked arms and they sang A Mighty Fortress and they didn't sing We Shall Overcome, but refused to give in, and the Nebraska shut, they arrested the leaders, and they shut down, they padlocked the church. And now there's been a reconciliation, sort of a compromise, which was made in Nebraska. But the government the groups I'm talking about here, the Moonies and the rest in this group of this coalition I talked about at the Holiday Inn in Central and Minneapolis, see this as an organized conspiracy on the part of the government to clamp down on unpopular, religious organizations in the country. And they are ready, to resist, even if you can imagine moral majority and American Civil Liberties Union people, standing side by side. And I'm following this, and all I can say right now is it's still very much in a state of transition. What happened, fascinating, and just then I'll go into the conferences, what happened, it was absolutely fascinating, was that the leaders of the conference in Minneapolis asked for volunteers to go to Danbury and stand there on the day that Moon went to jail. And about 10 people stood up and said they would do it to show their particular support for them, because they see any form, of government regulation over revenue as interference. That's the basic difference. The Supreme Court in the long run will win, but on the other hand, it has to be said with the Supreme Court that quite rightly, and I think very wisely so, it wants to stay out as much as possible of internal church or ecclesiastical disputes. They do not want to get involved in matters which churches or denominations themselves should settle. For instance, some of you may have had some experiences with this. Say you've got, we've got one in, they did settle it peacefully, but I'll use it as an example. Some of you know up around our part of the country, Shakopee, the ALC church in Shakopee decided that the minister was too liberal, and I won't go into the details of that, so they pulled out. Okay. A nice little phrase came in the bottom in the fine print in Lutheran Standard, that they've been formally removed from the church rules or something else like that. But in some congregations, what's happened is that the people who moved out say that we are the true congregation, and therefore we're entitled to the property. We're entitled to the building and all the, all the equipment and everything else. And the people who are there say, no, we are the true, custodians of we're the true members of the church. And so what do you do, everything else in American life today, we'll fight it all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court doesn't want to touch these things at all, because that would be a matter of deciding which was the more orthodox or the more correct in doctrine in terms of that particular phase. This long, long struggle. Okay, so the Supreme Court generally wants to stay out, but they decided to get involved in this one. Okay, and that's where the battle is right now with the cults, with this particular cult, at least with the Mooney cult, and I'm watching to see what's going to happen in Nebraska with that one also. And so, that's an indication of how significant I think the Mooney controversy is. A couple of things about the background. One thing is surprising about the Moonies, because in terms of total numbers, there are only 30,000 in the whole country. Some people think there might be many more, but 30,000, that's a repeat, and that was told to us by the number two man at the conference we were at. And I think that indicates something very significant about the Moonies also. And that is that people are surprised when you say that, because if you would read, Psychology Today or People Magazine or even National Enquirer, you get at the checkout, I don't know if it's Kroger out here or Safeway out here, isn't it, right? We've got Red Elf. But if you do it, You'd think that the Moonies were right up there with Joan Collins and Richard Chamberlain and all the other people of all the terrible things that are going on in America, right now. The Moonies have gotten an incredible press basically because of this idea of brainwashing. And that's what, I was trying to convince Eric that I hadn't been brainwashed, because starting when the cults first got started in this country, there were all kinds of stories, horror stories, about going off to meetings and being lured in and being indoctrinated and using almost like Chinese water torture test, techniques on them. And there were evidences, for instance, that there were some places where children had been brought in, or young people even into their 20s had been brought in, and had rejected their parents. And there got to be a terrific controversy for a long period of time. And this makes news. I mean, National Enquirer, People Magazine, 2020, if you remember that one, I'm trying to think, 60 Minutes did it once with this outfit out in Oregon here. Some of you may know. Yes. They all wear orange clothes, and they have 43 Rolls Royces for the guru, and all Ontario, is it? Ontario, Oregon?
Antelope,
that's right. Ontario, Oregon, Antelope, that's right. So cults are in the news because there's clash, there's drama, there's passion, all these different things. And so people looked at the Moonies, and they became very, very visible because of that reason. And I'm not going to minimize the fact that there have been some very serious tensions that have developed. And I'm very much aware of the fact that when I do something like a talk on the Moonies or on cults, I oftentimes get some letters in the mail, or I get phone calls from parents. My daughter or my son went over to the Moonies or Divine Light or Hare Krishna or whatever it is, and how can you say anything at all kind about something that took away my child? And I'm very much aware of that, and that keeps happening all the time. Okay, so I'm trying to be responsible about that. So they got a lot of publicity, even though there are, as I say, 30,000 because of that, and also because of their politics. Reverend Moon comes out of Korea, and starting, remember, right after World War II, Korea was divided between the communists and the South Koreans, and the country itself is still bitterly divided today. Some of you remember old Panmunjom and the 38th parallel and all these different things that went on there. And Moon and the Moonies themselves, the Unification Church, are very, very strongly anti-communist. This is one of the chief attributes, and this has become very controversial within American political life, because they divide the world into either right or wrong, light or darkness, whatever it might be, and they are altogether opposed to any form of communism at all, and hence that gets a lot of attention in the country. I'll give you one example. Some of you might remember it was 73. Yeah, 73. Every year, you remember, right before Christmas, they have on television the national lighting of the television crew on the White House lawn, sort of thing. And I watched the one year, and I didn't know anything about the Moonies at that time. And they panned on the bleachers, and every seat in the bleachers was taken by Moonies, and they were all sitting waving American flags. Because they saw Richard Nixon, President Nixon, as the person they thought who was finally ready to stand up and defeat the communists. And that got all kinds of publicity. And I talked at the conferences to a couple of the people who had been at that flag waving service, and they talked about that sort of thing. Okay, so for those reasons, because of the charge of brainwashing, that they've taken children away from their parents, and all the rest, and because of the anti-communism thing, the Moonies have had, a very bad press. And I'm going to argue a little bit later on that some of it's, very deserved for some of it. Okay. So what they've been trying to do in the last about five, six years, obviously, is to win over, if not the general public, if not those who read the National Enquirer, who, what's the latest controversy this week? Is Joan Collins going to divorce whoever the latest one is? And she's the one that's, every time I check out at Red Olive, she's involved in something more. And Linda Evans, isn't it, with Richard Chamberlain, and all that sort of stuff. And so if they can't find something new each week for them, they've got to find something like the Moonies or something else like that. Okay, so the Moonies are aware of the very bad press, and they also know that they have an enormous amount of money. And this is something I want to talk about. The money comes not from America. They don't make money selling flowers at airports or candy at the shopping malls or things like that. They use those particular programs to teach obedience and discipline to their, to their novitiates or to the initiates. So they don't make money up at IDS Tower or wherever it might be, at whatever shopping mall it is in Seattle or Portland or wherever you might come from. But they are used to teach them order, discipline, and respect for their authorities. I'll give you one example. When we were at the conference, we had a chance to talk at great length with one particular Moonie, Anthony Guerrera. And he was given $20 and a bus ticket to Madison, Wisconsin. And that was it for the Moonies, and he was on his own from that point on. And was supposed to, you know, develop it, take it from that point, and he, you know, developed his own kinds of skills at survival. And what they needed, obviously, was quick cash, you know, right away. And he was able to find a couple others who were sympathetic for him and start a small Mooney particular group in Madison. And he said they didn't make any money, but he certainly learned a lot about taking care of himself and trying to, you know, evangelize or proselytize, if you like, for that particular group. Okay. So they were aware of the bad press. They were also aware that they have an enormous amount of money. Most of it comes from Japan. The Mooney Church is much, much larger in Japan than it is anywhere else in the world. And they have a few very wealthy Japanese who simply give, you know, almost unlimited amounts of money to the organization. Some comes from Korea also, a little bit from some African companies, but basically from Japan. And like when I was a boy and my father had just given me the allowance, the money burned a hole in my pocket. If you've got money, you spend it. They want to spend it especially for PR. And what they've been doing is sponsoring series of conferences, especially for academics, in different very exotic and attractive parts of the world. It was a year ago, it would have been the spring then of 1983, I received a letter from Unification Seminary in Berrytown, New York, inviting me to a conference, and it turned out to be in the Sheraton Hotel, a very posh jet-set hotel on the island of Madeira, which is just off the coast of Africa. And when my roommate and I looked in our, you know, behind, on the inside of the door, when you, you know, in a hotel they always have the rates, $150 a day. That was, you know, a lot of money for a farm boy from southern Minnesota, I must say, and who's height of luxury before had been the old Curtis Hotel was about, if you really wanted to swing, and now you can't do that anymore in Minneapolis. Maybe you saw, some of you saw that it was blown up and so on. Anyway, and they brought 300 academics who were interested in one way or another in the thing we call religious studies to Madeira. And there for 7 days, we had discussions of Mooney theology and of Mooney practices. And then there was no party line, there was no hidden agenda, that has to be said. There was no time in which, you know, they said, aha, now we have you, now, you know, we're going to spring the trap and you're all going to go back, you know, as at least moderately converted kind of Moonies. Not at all. They encouraged controversy. This is one of the strange things. They said we want controversy, and we would take, and they certainly got it, we would take one doctrine each day. Like we started with creation, then God and fall and things like that, and they, we would have long discussions. We would have 4 hours of theological dispute. And if you want to, you know, start yearning very much for lunch, go to a four-hour conference on the Mooney doctrine of creation. If you know anything about Asian philosophy, which I don't, about the principles of yin and yang and opposites and all the rest of these things, and we're sitting there and all I could think about was lunch. Because it was, you know, we were at the Sheraton, it was right on the seashore and overlooking the Atlantic, and very, very nice, to be sure, but they encouraged controversy, that was fine, and we had prepared papers ahead of time. You were asked ahead of time to prepare a paper on the Mooney Doctrine, and I prepared one, for instance, on the fall. I'll talk about that a little later, on the capital F-A-L-L, and so on. And then we would really go at it, and there would be an honest exchange back and forth, and then we had the distinct feeling that it had just gone in one ear and out the other, that this was a very nice intellectual exercise. We all had talked about how open-minded and, you know, tolerant and generous and kind and respectful we were for one another, and, you know, nothing happens, because they've been having these conferences for 4 or 5 years, and some people who have been at other ones who I talked to said, we said those things at our conference 2 years ago, and then we look at Mooney theology and, you know, nothing has changed. It's like that old expression, you know, if you remember when you were a kid, if you tried to find the bar of soap in the bathtub, and you squeezed, the harder you squeezed, the surer you were that the bar of soap was going to get away from you. What's that old one? Remember when we were kids, we had those little autograph books you wrote, little things to friends. Don't it get you mad? Don't it get you mad? Don't it get your goat when you're in the bathtub and can't find the soap? Isn't that the one? Yeah. And we were looking for the soap. We were looking for, you know, something I could get a hold of on the doctrine of the fall. And when I squeezed a little hard on some sort of scriptural authority or whatever it is, it just sort of eluded me and got away. And that was fascinating because the second conference I went to was It was only in February, and it was only in San Juan, Puerto Rico, that we went for our second conference. So you see how tough it is to be a Mooney follower, and or as they like to call them, Moon Watchers is what they like to call them. And it was 35 below when I left, I used to still call it Will Chamberlain Airport in Minneapolis, and it was 95 above when we got to San Juan. And wow, anyway, one of the most careful students of Mooney theology teaches at Toronto, Herb Richardson, and he'd been watching the Moonies for about 10 years. And we were going through the usual song and dance and on the fall or creation or something like this. And they were very evasive about this. They said, we're still working on that doctrine. Because you see, Reverend Moon had his encounter, he believes directly and physically with Jesus, when he was a 16-year-old boy on the hillside in Korea on Easter 1936. And they're still developing some of their ideas. And Herb really went after me. He said, you know, you've been going at this thing now for over 40 years. It's about time you take a stand on some of these issues. And that's what I meant about the metaphor of the bar of soap. That it's about time they start coming to some conclusions on these sort of things. Well, anyway, so what would happen at the conference was that we would have a long discussion back and forth for, say, for 4 hours on each of these. And there would be a break. Which was very nice, and, you know, sitting out there and having fresh squeezed orange juices, and there was the Atlantic, you know, never got below 60 or above 80 in Madeira and things like that. And then there would be lunch, and then we would have a five-hour tourist thing where we would do the usual tourist things. There isn't that much in Madeira except to see Madeira lace and Madeira wine, and that's right, that's where you get Madeira wine, and it's just an old extinct volcano. It's a large island about 20 miles wide and about 6-7 miles wide, 20 miles long and 26 miles wide. And then we would go back, and at 6 o'clock, we were divided into groups of about 15 each, and there'd be one or two career Moonies in their 20s or 30s, and I'll explain that in a minute, who were there. And we would just talk. What is it like day by day, day in and day out, to be a Moonie? What do you do? What about the charges of brainwashing? What about some of the stuff? Does Moon really consider himself to be the Lord of the Second Advent? That Jesus didn't quite finish the job because he got involved with those Roman politicians and they got rid of him, and so therefore God wants to complete his creation, and he did so by sending somebody else, not a Gentile, but sending in this case a Korean. And you really believe that stuff? You know, what happens in the Mooney houses? What about these people who wrote books, Crazy for God or Moonwashed or things like that? We had a chance to talk every day for 6 days with each group had a chance to talk on a small, almost one-to-one basis with the Moonies. And that was fascinating. To me, that was the most interesting part of the conference. I really don't care much for metaphysical doctrines and theology and things like that, because it's also kind of arbitrary. But we had a chance to talk with them, and what we found there, and that was the one impressive thing that we found with the Moonies, and they were very open about the money, for instance, they were very open about Moon's case with the Supreme Court, was the thing that surprised us was that the ones we met, to be sure, they were the best and the brightest. These were graduate students in the very best divinity schools and graduate schools in the United States. Tony was a fourth-year PhD candidate in the divinity school at Harvard, and they were from Yale, from Princeton, you know, from Columbia, Claremont in California, Chicago. These were young, very idealistic, highly dedicated, and strongly motivated people who were the avant-garde, really, or the forerunner of the Moonies, the movement itself. Moon has the idea that you can't do much with anybody over 50. Remember, you can't trust anybody over 30. Moon doesn't trust anybody pretty much over 50, really. So he started with the younger generation. Okay. And Moon himself came to this country in 1972 and was able to attract, to be sure, a very small but a very able number of highly idealistic and dedicated young people, the very best. I was very impressed. I've been, you know, through graduate school, and my friends who were there were all academics, had been through that. We found these were, you know, the best, and for the most part, they were very, you know, upfront about some of their answers, about the finances, about the brainwashing thing, what went on in the communal houses, and all the rest of these things. The place that they became quiet was when we asked them, do you really think the Moon is divine? That was one where they weren't, and the other thing where do you think you're going to be able to go with this particular, religion of yours? Say you get a PhD in Old Testament or, church history or whatever it might be. Do you really think that some college is going to hire, if you've got a chance, as they do now, of having about four or five, you know, good candidates for every job? Do you think some school, like, take a random, example, St. Olaf, will hire somebody in New Testament who has a Mooney background, rather than somebody who comes from Augsburg or, you know, whatever the case might be. And they were extremely hopeful about this. And but that's all, they didn't have much more to say about that because they really don't know what's going to happen in the future. They've joined the church, and the church really takes care of them. In a way, it's like the old 19th, it's very much like the 19th century communal groups. Some of you remember Oneida, they were called the Perfectionists out of Oneida, New York, or the Shakers, who had their communal groups, or several of the others. You join the group, they've got the money, they've got the program, and they'll take care of you. And you don't really, you know, think that much about what's down the line. And that was something which I found to be, you know, remarkable about them. Where to go with that? And then I started asking around, you know, what if you're that bright? I mean, these are the very best. Why get into a group as really weird with some really strange, weird ideas like the Moonies have? For instance, when I was doing the thing on the fall, I found out that their doctrine of how did original sin enter into the world? It wasn't, you know, through the story of Adam and Eve and the tree of knowledge or anything else. Their theory of the doctrine of the fall was that Lucifer, who was the chief agent of Satan, Lucifer committed spiritual fornication with Eve. And in that way, and I don't know, I'm not any clear about it, more clear about it than you are right now, having studied it for a while. You know, that just is really way out there somewhere. How can this, you know, appeal to you? How do you follow in sort of a logical, step-by-step analyses how you do this? How can you go to a good place like Harvard Divinity School where you're trained in logic and rationality and all the rest, and then suddenly when it comes time to your own particular faith, you know, you make this particular leap and leave behind your, you know, put your thinking cap behind, to use that old metaphor, and jump into something else like this? And we went around and around on that for a long period of time. And so I asked them that, and what I found invariably was that they joined because it was a very deep personal need for an all-out kind of commitment. I'll give you two examples. One was a boy from Chisago City, Minnesota, George Anderson, who happened to be his name, no relation to the president of Luther College, if you're wondering, who was also George Anderson. But George was a combat veteran from Vietnam and had gone in when he was 18, had many of the very severe experiences of any Vietnamese combat veteran, came back having had sort of a, you know, much larger worldview, seen the world, seen, you know, parts of Southeast Asia, obviously he had never seen before, and wanted to do something dramatic and something powerful and all-encompassing to not let anything like Vietnam happen again. And he grew up in a good Lutheran church, and I choose it deliberately because of the Lutheran connection here, in Chisago City, and that's about as Swedish Lutheran as my hometown. You know, Kenyon is Norwegian Lutheran. And no help there. He went to the University of Minnesota for a couple of years after he got back with the GI Bill and all the rest, tried different kinds of agencies there. Nobody was interested or nobody could respond to the kinds of needs that George had. The only people who had the kind of vision, the world view, and the sort of the exciting idea that we were in on something brand new and different and that was going to, you know, shake the world were the Moonies. And he joined the Moonies, and he went 2 years to their seminary in Barrytown, which is about 2 hours north of New York City on the Hudson. And now he's finishing up his PhD in government at Claremont. That would be one example. He was a combat veteran. The other one would be, what was his name? Sterling Towne. He came from an upper class, very wealthy family in Connecticut, had a Yale education, and during the middle 60s became committed or converted to pacifism and became a conscientious objector, just the opposite of George. George was a combat veteran. And went to jail, went to Fort Leavenworth for refusing to even register for the draft. And what he said, one fascinating thing, you can imagine how popular wealthy Yale graduates who are CEOs are in a federal prison, the kind of treatment they got there. And he said he was better treated by his fellow inmates at Leavenworth than he was when he was out, trying to raise money, in the airports and the shopping malls where he was spit on. By people who found out that he was a Moonie. But that was just one, I thought, an interesting aside. But he was a CEO and came out and found nobody interested in what he was trying to do, win the world through peace and love and these things. The only church that offered him as strong and exciting a vision of what he really wanted to do was the Moonie Church, and now he's finishing up his PhD in New Testament at Yale and working, you know, with some very reputable people there. So that was my clue as to why these people really wanted to, once they got in, and once they were in, why they stayed. They had a vision of something that they didn't find in the ordinary everyday churches. And some people have said that the cults such as Hare Krishna and Divine Light and the Moonies are something of a criticism or something of a judgment really on the churches today, that they can't provide the kind of idealism and vision that some people are looking for. I just mentioned that as one kind of comment for this. Okay, so that was the experience I had, and I came back feeling with a much, what should I say, much enlarged vision of the Moonies. But I came back and sort of tried to assess this thing. There was my son, as I say, waiting for me at the airport and looking for signs of being haggard or starved or something. We were very tired. The plane broke down, as planes in the summertime do, and I don't know how long we sat waiting in JFK to get off. Some of you remember that, how long it takes forever to get out of JFK in the summertime. But I was tired, but not because we had been systematically brainwashed or something. But I tried to sum up things, and I came up with this conclusion. I went for three reasons. One, I wanted a vacation, and it was a very nice vacation. It was everything was paid for. The time I stepped out of my door until the time I got back again, all the transportation and food and all that was paid for. That was nice. Secondly, I wanted to learn about the Moonies, and I learned about the Moonies. And third, besides learning about these people I've talked about, like George, I met some people who have become good friends. I met people who were in exactly the same, the same field as I was. A good friend of mine from Northeastern Illinois, Greg Singleton, and I, we teach exactly the same subjects. I mean, it just became silly. We started talking. I teach that one, or you do too, and I went here, and I've written that, and down the line, and we're good friends. And I met some fascinating people. One day we were sitting at coffee, and it turned out to be a fascinating fellow. He was a Jesuit priest, but he was also a practicing psychiatrist in Manila, in the Philippines. Now, that's a whole lot more interesting than, talking with some historian back at, Northfield, Minnesota. You just don't get that kind of, diversity and flavor. And so I was, delighted to have that sort of thing. But I came back and started thinking about the cult sort of thing, and started reading more about this. And this is the reason I have this book on the board here. There's so many more things to be said, but I want to get to questions. If you're interested, and I certainly recommend this for your church library. This is why I put it down here. She is a Catholic nun who has her PhD in psychology, and she has taught courses in cults and sects and in what we call the human potential movement. And here Mostache, I've got the book, I'm not sure, that's a Greek name, isn't it? I think it'll be Greek Mostache, and it's simply called Searchings, by the Stavron Educational Press, New York, 1983. And it is extremely objective. You can go straight down the line, and it just provides a great deal of information. And I say that because what's happened since the cults and the Moonies are so controversial, that you are either very enthused about them, or you are very critical of them. And I've seen some books that have clever titles, like, it's a very clever title. There's one by InterVarsity Press. It's called "The Moon Is Not the Sun," and the S-O-N is spelled S-O-N, which is a very clever title. But the book itself is about three quarters just stuff that should rather be in National Enquirer. And on the other hand, you've got some books that are much too strongly in favor of the cults. So I really recommend this one. It's helped me a great deal. Searchings by this one. This is not your household word kind of publisher like Augsburg or Fortress or Westminster, or Harper for that matter, or Harcourt Brace, or any of the others. But certainly if you're interested in a book, because a lot of young people have questions about this, and I'm sure if you come from especially larger cities, young people are going to come in contact one way or another with the cults, or with the Way, that's another one, which is strong in some parts of the country. Okay, so I'd like to kind of finish with using her criticisms very briefly on what she finds to be the shortcomings, really, of the Moonies. And I'll just read these quickly, and then we'll have plenty of time, really, I think, for discussion. Okay, she says this: many individuals and businesses are disturbed by the large number of industries in which Moon and his followers are involved. He has a huge empire. Some of you remember even there was a movie two summers ago, Inchon. They spent $48 million, and it was an absolute bomb. But they have the money to do this. They own a newspaper in Washington, D.C. The church publishes a newspaper, right, News World. Owns a carpet cleaning company and tea company, runs several restaurants and fishing fleets. That's just in Massachusetts, among other business enterprises. And critics note that Moonie-run businesses have an unfair advantage since their labor is supplied freely and they cannot destroy competitors. However, many non-unificationists avoid doing business with any company that is related to the church. So there are, you wonder how much the church, is the church involved too deeply in business operations? And is it using it, using the profits for the most worthwhile purposes? Second criticism, that many members regard Moon as the absolute authority regarding church-related and other matters. Many former members indicated that while they were part of the movement, they would have done anything Moon asked of them. And we found this with most of them. There was no real, you know, criticism of the church itself. When you would bring up something like this point isn't clear or isn't that point kind of silly, they would say that's in process. We're still working on that. And that hasn't really been settled yet. And I can understand it. Have any of you tried reading Divine Principle, just for fun? The book, it's the sacred text really of this, of the group. And when we accepted the invitation to come, we promised to read Divine Principle, the sort of the Bible of the Moonies, before we came to the conference. And we all received copies of it. And it was funny. Since it was Madeira Island, it belongs to Portugal, we used Air Portugal airline out of JFK. And I got to the lounge at Air Portugal waiting for the flight, and that's where everybody else from all over the country, there were about 200 Americans or USAs where the people were there, and everybody else was where I was with reading the Divine Principle. We were all on page 3. dissertation, the prose is very murky and turgid. I do pots and pans in the dish team, and the dishwater yesterday reminded me of the prose there. But okay. The third, and this criticism is made of the deceptive practices sometimes used by the church. The term heavenly deception was frequently employed to describe instances of deceit in the pursuit of a unification church goal. For example, many current and former members indicated that they were initially unaware that the group they had joined was affiliated with the Unification Church. A number of individuals told me that they had lied during fundraising because of the bad name of the church in the public's mind and the consequent difficulty of soliciting contributions in a direct fashion. And she gives more examples of that. A fourth major criticism concerns the exploitation and overworking of members. This is the one that gets a lot of parents interested. I've been to rallies, for instance, in the Twin Cities, where parents get together, what can we do to get our children back again? And this is what they're talking about here. Although soliciting for funds is often related, I'll skip that point here. The fact still remains that the members work extremely hard. For example, one member describing his fundraising experiences commented, "We usually get up at 5 or 6, then we have a morning prayer service. Sometimes we go 100 days or more without a break. It's natural to live like that. I sleep about 2 or 3 hours a night, but we're inspired by Reverend Moon's work." And on with that sort of thing. The fifth criticism, the suggestion of widespread political dimensions and connections of the Unification Church. And here is something that sort of resonates with my interest in religion and politics. A number of investigators, and some of you from Minneapolis, it's Don Fraser, who the mayor now, who then was in Congress, led the investigation of some of the Moonie political connections and so on. Congressional committees, and that's Fraser's when he was there, have suggested ties between the church and the Korean government, and the reports of church munitions factories have also circulated. There's no question about that. The Korean government wanted more influence in Washington. And my own personal feeling is that Moon went to Washington not only because he had a larger audience with which to work in the United States than he had in Korea, but he thought he could more directly influence the United States in terms of the anti-communist policy which he was in favor of. And where some of the money, it's like I talked about Jesse Jackson before, remember, getting Arab money, I don't think there's any question, but there is a good deal of Mooney money around in Washington, which is very hard, you know, to track, especially since we know how to launder money nowadays, and where it shows up. I don't think there's any question about that. And politicians have learned that if they get associated with Mooney money, you know, it's virtually the kiss of death with us. Okay. A final area of criticism concerns the charge that when the children join the church, they become alienated from their families. Okay, that's what I wanted to get into the last thing here with the wedding. I've passed around the picture of the wedding here. The Moonies we talked to said that their parents were in support and in favor of what they were doing. And to me, the last point with the Moonies is the wedding thing, because that always comes up. When you have to be 25 to join the church. You can be interested before, but they don't want flash in the pan types. They don't want them who might be 17 or 18 and are looking for a cause. They've left home, or they can't stand the parents or high school or whatever it is, and very impressionable kind of thing. They're waiting, the Moonies wait till you're 25, and once, you know, you made that kind of commitment, then they feel you're more stable and can make your own judgments. They don't really go for recruits over 40 either. especially because of the biological thing for reproduction. That's extremely important with the Moonies. They want, you know, like we were told when we were kids growing up in these small Lutheran towns, we were told the reason Catholics didn't have birth control was that they wanted to have as many troops as possible for taking over the country, and they had arsenals in the basement of the church. And we, you know, my parents didn't believe that, but boy, in Kenyon, we didn't buy from Flick, the Catholic grocer, or, you know, all the rest of the things. Okay. The Moonies want troops, and they want to encourage the family. The paradigm or the model is always the family. Between 25 and 40 are the best childbearing years. Okay. So they follow the old matchmaking policies of Korea. Matchmaking is nothing new. I mean, matchmaking goes way, way back into history. Remember Hello Dolly? There's an example, you remember, of matchmaking. So we shouldn't be surprised or shocked that Moon himself is a matchmaker. That's all I'm trying to say here. But they have some very unusual ways of going about this. If you join, when you join the Mooney Church, you are expected to be married. There's no question, flat, straight out, you are expected to get married. Then people say it's that's why some people join. That for whatever reason, they haven't been able to be married before, and that's why you join. Just like the charge was made, and it's not true. In the Mormon Church in the 19th century, they practiced polygamy. The argument was because there were so many more women than men. That was the argument, and that therefore you had to have something for all these unmarried women to do, so even if you were wife number three or four, at least you were married, which was more than you were before. And as it turned out, there were more men than women in the Mormon Church in the 19th century. Yeah.
Where did the Mooney women come from?
Yeah, they're 25 and 40. They're all from all over the world, especially from third world countries. Especially
from
third world
countries. Are they already Moonies?
Yeah. They're already Moonies. So they start recruiting about 18, 19. They're active in large cities, college campuses, and so on. Okay. So you join the church. Then you're expected to get married. You write out pretty much your own autobiography and what you would like, you know, in your mate. And this is printed up and sent to Reverend Moon, and he will go around where there are Mooney centers, and might take his anywhere from 50 to 100 women and 50 to 100 men, and he will read their statements and biographies. He will interview them briefly, and then he will just line them up and say, you and you and you and you and you and you. That's it. Yep. And when God is telling you that, you know, people say, why do you do it? Why do you have the mass marriages where everybody is dressed exactly the same way? If God is the minister, that's thinking big over what's going on here. So then after you've been paired, you have 48 hours to talk over things, and there is no recrimination or anything at all. You can imagine that's a lot of talking. I think I talk fast. You talk fast, and then there's no recrimination if after the 48 hours you decide you're not going to get married. That nobody says anything. That's just the way it is. Nobody says anything. But after the 48 hours, if it seems to be, you know, the vibrations or whatever it is seem to be right, then you are betrothed. And then it can take anywhere from 3 months. And poor Tony was still waiting. He had been engaged for 8 years, wasn't it? 7 years. And, he's 38 years old by this time, and he wanted to be a father. A very normal, natural sort of thing. But Reverend Moon had said, wait. And, you know. Then on the other hand, it has to be said, we thought, you know, when we saw some of these people who hadn't been married yet, a bunch of sex-starved maniacs, the very normal, stable, we didn't see any kind of evidence at all of, and they could boogie down as well as anything. Two nights we had dances, and they could do, you know, they were doing all the most up-to-date dances. They wore ordinary, everyday clothes. You know, people were wondering what in the world they were coming out, and I don't know what they expected them to wear, sackcloth or something, but they, in many ways, they, you know, extremely normal. After 48 hours, you become engaged. Then anywhere from 3 months on, it could last as long as Reverend Moon wants it to last. Then there is the mass wedding. The last mass wedding was in Madison Square Garden in July or June, anyway, it's in the picture there, of 1982. 2,076 couples were married. And then, I wish he had picked another number, then, even then, as they like to put it so neatly, consummation isn't available for you right away. I mean, some people were wondering, you have to wait another, and they would have to choose 40 days for the, I don't know why they chose 40 days to wait before consummation, like going into the wilderness and being tempted for 40 days to see if you could live with a spouse that you've been engaged to and God told you to marry, and you still had to wait another 40 days. Maybe they figured if you could wait another 40 days after that, boy, you are really in control of things. I don't know. But anyway, you have to wait. If the marriage goes ahead, you have to wait another 40 days. Then you're expected to multiply and be fruitful. And the Moonies encourage large families. For instance, the question came up, what about birth control? What about, where did Mooney stand on abortion, for instance? That's, you know, a major issue today and all the rest. And one of the Moonies made a fascinating statement that since we're at least 25 and all the rest of the things, and since we want as many children as possible, we don't even talk about IUDs or contraception or abortion or anything else. That just isn't an issue for us at all. Then the question came up, what about divorce? If you're going to stay in the church, you stay with your mate. And even though there may be, you know, difficulties, if Reverend Moon has brought you together, that's it. If you leave the church, then you are, or if you leave your spouse, then you are also out of the church. That's how strong the, you know, the enforcement is. We saw about seven of the couples and talked to them very openly and freely. We went on a couple, you know, the sightseeing bus things. I sat with this nice couple for most of the afternoon talking about them, and they were very affectionate towards each other. They'd never met each other, you see, before the, you know, before the matchmaking. And they'd been married a few months, and they seemed very affectionate and friendly towards another. Very genuine, you know, we kept looking at them and taking little quick peeks. Do they just hold hands when we're watching them, or, you know, things like that? No, that wasn't the case at all. They're used to, you know, Gentiles like us watching them all the time. So we found that they seemed to be genuinely, you know, fond of each other. And that, I don't want to draw any conclusions on that. As I say, matchmaking is an old tradition in all the major religions of the world. But that would be where I would want to leave it. And we've got about 15 minutes before we quit. Yeah.
One question I'd like to clarify. Sure. One thing. You made a statement that cults were in large cities. I'm from Mankato.
Mankato. Oh.
Okay. We have a Wisconsin-based cult.
You've got that one. Yeah.
We have had a lot of problems with. Number one, I remember one time in Mankato, we had to get rid of a teacher.
Yeah.
Here a while back, we had the... our thing that occurred down in Winona.
Yeah, I'm at the Islers.
Relates to a wrestling coach who brought a troubled husband and his wife in. So it's not like we have a big problem with the cult.
I'm glad you mentioned that, and that's the one with Bill Eilers, and that case that went to the Supreme Court, and that's out of Shawano County, Wisconsin, which is very rural. And he's not, they're not Moonies, though. That group isn't a Moonie.
No, they're different. Yeah. But then my next question relates to Moonies.
Thank you.
We have never had Moonies in Mankato before.
Yeah.
They've never bothered to come to Mankato.
Right.
Okay, we had
the same group
come down you talked about.
Yeah.
The Holiday Inn in Mankato, telling about how terrible it was. The ministers, the same group you spoke of.
Oh, yeah. They came there.
Came to Mankato, gave their talk, and following that up, the Moonies arrived selling their flowers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now,
they're organized.
Does that mean anything? Are they expanding outwards? Are they looking for more? Is it a college town?
Yeah, they go for college towns. They're, you know, idealistic youth, kind of rootless youth, and so on. But they're very well organized, and they are very opportunistic. And I say this as a very strong criticism of them. They have groups who travel. Maybe they'll go to a town and, quote, work a town. Like Fuller Brush, you remember, used to do. Some of the young people don't even know what Fuller Brush salesmen are. But anyway, remember Red Skelton's thing on Fuller Brushmen? But anyway, they will work a town for 2-3 weeks, and if it's profitable, they'll stay. And if they don't, they'll simply move on. And they see this as part of the higher good. Very, 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 no question about this, very opportunistic. I'd like to talk to you because two of my friends who went to that same conference as I did are at MSU, Mary Jo Metter and Bob Rickers, and thank you.
The friend you talked about that was getting his PhD at Yale, Princeton, if he had been engaged for 7 years, why is he keeping him that way?
His that case with Tony, I have to say that's an exceptional case. She said, why if Moon wants families and all the rest, did he keep Tony engaged without being able to consummate for 7 years? Tony's fiance had come from Korea when she was about 15, and she was still very young, and she happened to be a domestic maid at the Moon household. And Moon, I think Moon liked a good, he found a good mate is what it was, and he's trying to hold on to her, I think, my own personal feeling. But he said she was just too young, and it needed more time to mature.
That he would want your friend to make sure and stay in the church if he's such a hot shot.
Yeah, yeah. He was a hot shot, but I felt sorry for poor Tony. He was so dedicated,
Just one observation that comes to my mind, you mentioned the fact that he was... and infant castigation.
Yeah.
The two things that come to my mind are that some other notorious people who have finally been jailed for income tax evasion, Al Capone and Jimmy Hoffa, tax related.
Yep.
Even though their crimes, so to speak, were much other.
Yeah, right.
Other than that, and I can see the forces at work against Moon, the brainwashing, the influence peddling, and so on. But this is the only perhaps legal way at this point in time in which he could be legitimately attacked. And also the fact that coming under the religious nonprofit organization, this is the one area where.
I agree with the government. It's not often that I agree with good old Infernal Revenue, you know. But that's one place where I do, because they have enterprises that are making money, and Moon had the question is a matter of definition. Moon had $55,000 in his own income, in his own bank account, and he was saying, I'm not using that for myself. And the government was saying, well, then it shouldn't be in your bank account. And he needs a better lawyer, is what he needs. Yeah.
That's the other question I had is. It seems to me that a highly centralized cult like that, the one evidence of that would be personal enrichment by the leader, or at least the disciples, very close to the leader. Yep. I think of the media people that you see, you know, Jimmy Swaggart and
so on. Oh, boy. Yeah, absolutely.
Is that evident in the movie?
They have a very... They have a very high regard for the academic and for their leaders. They want their leaders to, you know, to live well. And Moon bought one of these big old mansions that became, you know, a tax white elephant up in, this is in Tarrytown, there's Berrytown and Tarrytown. And lives well there, but not, you know, not palatially or something else like that, but they live well. And the friends I know who have been there say that it's pleasant and it's comfortable, but it's, you know, it's nothing, you know, overdone. With that, and there's no evidence that they're using it, you know, for their own. They don't have sunken jacuzzi baths or that look out on mountains or anything like that. And with Taylor, you're right. There's always a little sin in the world, right? Yeah.
Are they encouraged to hold jobs outside?
Yes. Yeah, it depends on after a while, especially when you're married, and if you've been through recruitment. Then you either start another recruitment house somewhere else, or else you go out into the world. And you see, they're just now, 72 is when they got started, and they're just now getting people who are in their 30s who are going out into the world. And so this is still open. But you're either still in graduate school, or else you have a job, and you can have your own apartment if you have a family. If you don't have a family, you still live in the communal house.
Do you then turn that money
back
to the church?
Yeah.
But they provide for your basic needs?
Yeah.
I mean, they provide for food?
Yeah, they provide for food and car fare. And
do they pay your tuition too?
Yes, they pay. That's another thing with Tony. He wondered about how is it going to look when somebody finds out that all his bills were paid for by the church. That has to be taken into account. It's not peanuts to go to Yale Divinity School, as I found out from my son. So, yeah.
When we recently made a trip to Central America, we were told down there that Moon was behind a big push to form right-wing student organizations in high schools and university campuses.
I personally wouldn't be surprised. One blind spot. I didn't mean if you had a question. I'm sorry because I get so carried away that I, you know. I wouldn't personally be surprised at all, because the people are, whatever you want to call it, manic really about the anti-communist thing, about anything that smacks of, you know, even something mild like even co-ops, I suppose, or something like socialism. And liberation theology would be considered altogether wrong, right. And it's strange, in one sense, they are absolutely devoted to Moon because they think that he really is the Lord of the Second Advent. Theologically, they're one. But there's a great deal of flexibility. It's like the Catholic Church used to be in the 19th century. You can create and do your own strategy and tactics according to the needs of your particular country. The American Catholic Church, you know, in the 19th century was much different than, let's say, the Spanish Catholic Church. And yet they were still under the same umbrella. And I think that's true with the Moonie Church in Latin America, that they are much different there than they are here. And they go for a different kind of person here in this country because they want a really good press with getting good people like Tony. Yeah.
So, anti-communist, how do they explain their position of everybody feeding their money into a central pool
and then dispensing it back? Yeah, that's... Okay, I'm not a Moonie, so I can only give you the... And I have to say, I was really disappointed the day we had the formal four-hour session on anti-communism. It was really, you know, it really wasn't very good. The fellow was apparently nervous or frightened or something else like that. But they would argue that the money is being used, I would say they would argue that the money is being used for a noble purpose, and that therefore it doesn't go for, you know, the improvement or the, you know, the, what should I say, the material wealth or gratification of any individual. and that there has to be some centralization to maximize use. See, all the old cliche, it takes money to make money. I suppose that's what the Moonies would say. And that therefore you need a good deal of working capital to get started with. And once you get started with it, you know, it's like the missionaries out to Hawaii. They came to do good and they stayed by doing well. Dole pineapple and all the rest. And I think that's what happened with the Moonies, that they've got a taste of really big bucks. Our conference, 300 academics in Madeira cost $900,000. Yep, $900,000. And they, you know, fine, glad to do it, yeah.
I wonder if it isn't a question for the Supreme Court to say, what is the church and what is the cult and what is the difference?
Boy, I'm glad you brought that up. The Supreme Court doesn't want to touch that at all, but then there can be real charlatans. And I can only use Minnesota examples. It was 2 years ago, the Minnesota State Supreme Court finally threw out a diploma mill, wasn't it? Because all you had to do was send in $25 and something else, and you would got to get a certificate saying you were a member of a clergy of this or that particular church. So the Minnesota State Supreme Court worked out a vague but still reasonably precise definition of what it would take to qualify for tax exemption, or who could, let's say, marry people if you were clergy and something else like that. So they want to, they're trying, but they want to be very careful about this, because as we know, with things like manger scenes in the public square or something else like this, or Christmas carols in the public schools, how sensitive people are to that. Very, very sensitive. And it's getting more sensitive than before. Yeah, let's see, I want to get somebody else some different questions, but okay, go ahead.
I just want to, is it growing?
No, I don't think it's growing. I have a theory, it's like an escalator. Some are always getting on and some are always getting off. We don't know how many are getting off. We are told how many join. They're happy to tell us that, but they don't tell us how many drop out.
Isn't their source of wealth growing?
Yes, the source of wealth, no question, is growing. Yeah, very much so, right. One last one here, because it's almost a quarter to.
Are the outstanding deprogramming stories kind of fading away?
There's a whole other thing, deprogramming. If you're over 21 and say you've been in a cult, and the deprogrammers, Ted Patrick and all the rest, come and, quote, kidnap you and work you over, in a motel work you over for 72 hours, isn't that an invasion of your civil rights, especially if you're over 21? And what's happening now is deprogramming is being, much more sharply controlled by the laws and by the courts. Patrick himself is in jail. That's a very tough kind of question. I certainly don't know the answer. That was the whole thing with that Mooney case, or not the Mooney case, but that other case in Mankato, a very tough one. So I'd be glad at coffee or under the bell or at the jacuzzi to talk about this further, because I think it's something that's very interesting for our time. And if any of you have any children with a question like this, I'd be happy to talk to you about that too, because I feel very strongly there. One last comment. And I've got 2-3 hours more about the movie, so.
Yes, for instance, is the church in Salt Lake City.
No. The Mormons, the Church of Latter-day Saints, no. Two things to look, I have to end it here because I want to eat the next 5 minutes too. Two things to look for with any group. Is the leader considered beyond question? That's one thing to look for if you're identifying what a cult is. Jim Jones is example, exhibit A. Is the leader beyond question? And how accountable is the church to any established board? I mean, are the books audited? Are the policies under some kind of review? Sometimes in our churches we just get discouraged because there's so much bureaucracy and red tape and it moves slow and all the rest of these things. And I just give you Jim Jones with Jonestown as an example of what can happen when you don't have bureaucracy, when you don't have red tape, when you don't have the leader accountable to anybody. That I think is the best thing when you talk to somebody about a group. Is the leader accountable to anybody else? And how do they report and publish publicly the financial records? I think that those are the two best tests you can make. So I'll be glad to talk about it further, and we've got 5 minutes before lunch. And I'll take my picture for my one audio visual.